The panel today, as I said earlier, we're going to get a little bit more sort of dive into the deep end on some of the more, if you will, microstructural issues that are of concern to us as regulators these days. And we position this around market quality because a lot of it really does have to do with quality as well as integrity. I have with me today, on my left, Stephen Bain, who's Managing Director and Head of Canadian Electronic Trading at RBC Capital Markets. Chris Concannon, who's Executive VP at Virtue Financial, one of the hot traders. Greg Berman on my far right. I mean it with all my heart. Greg Berman, Associate Director from the Office of Analytics and Research at the SEC, and I apologize for not mentioning the SEC this morning. Thank you for joining us, Greg. And Tal Cohen, CEO of Chi-X Global. So welcome. I think we're going to discuss some of these concepts and weave in, I think, some of the findings that Victoria presented and have a bit of debate around what those findings really tell us. But before we do that, I think we need to start with a bit of a discussion around what market quality is. We often hear the question, well, what's the difference between market quality and market integrity? And I think, you know, there are a lot of people out there that have different ideas of what market quality is and why it's important. So I'll ask the panel, you know, what do you think market quality is? What do you think it means to different people? And as a second part of that question, should regulators concern themselves with market quality? Or should we be focused on market integrity and those principles that were discussed this morning and let market quality sort of sort itself out? Around those principles and around a basic framework. Anyone feel like you want to start?
I'll start. I think that's probably a fairly difficult question. What is market quality? It's in the eye of the end user. So if you're a retail investor, you're going to have a view of what is market quality based on your interaction with the market. Was it a low fee? Did you get into a stock quickly? Did you get satisfaction right away? So end users, retail investors in particular, like immediate satisfaction. If you're a buy-side trader, market quality is an entirely different thing. It's how did the market react to my initial footprint in the market? Did it overreact? Did it underreact? Did I have the outcome that I wanted to have? So market quality is an entirely different thing for even these two end users, and as you go out throughout the spectrum of a big retail player to a small buy-side player to a large buy-side player, you get different reactions. I do think the regulator has an obligation to set a standard market quality, at least, and we talked about this fairness, some level of fairness, some impression of fairness to both the buy-side and the retail end users. And so there are obligations around market quality when it comes to fairness. And that does kind of blend with market integrity, but we do have to achieve. I think the biggest challenge with market quality is everyone studies it in a different way, and we come to these conclusions, these broad conclusions that the market has high quality or low quality, and right now I think everyone feels like we're in a low quality market, and that might just be macro reasons. But.
Yeah. Anyone else want to weigh in?
Years ago, there was a book, I think the book is actually quite old, but I read the book quite a while ago, called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. How many people here remember that book? Good. Do you remember that it actually starts off with the person saying, so I asked myself the question, what is quality? And then it ends where it explains how he actually drove himself crazy and actually wound up having to be committed because he thought too hard about the question, what is quality? So I'm a little nervous in trying to answer this question after reading that book about what is quality, but I can see where he's coming from. It is an incredibly difficult question because I think it really begs a broader question, is that different, as Chris said, different market participants demand different things from the market. Now, there are certain commonalities. No one likes if there's a technology issue and the market breaks. We don't hear a lot of feedback as a regulator say, hey, that's a great thing. We really love when there's a technology flaw. So pretty much universally, we can take off a lot of those aspects. No one likes that. But what about the more detailed measures that are the ones that really keep us up at night in terms of trying to make a decision in thinking about what would the effect of this rule be? What would the effect of that rule be? What's the implication of something on the markets? Are the markets better or worse for the rule? You know, that's an opinion, and it's very hard to regulate based on an opinion. Well, it's very hard for me to regulate based on that, but many others might be able to do that. But I like to try to measure something before and then measure something after. And that's where the question really lies is, what am I measuring before so that after something happens, I can see, did this thing that we were measuring, did it go up or down? And is up good or is down good? You should know that ahead of time. So what we had found is, and a lot of this can be traced back to the flash crash in 2010, we heard on that day liquidity was terrible. No liquidity at all. Highest volume day in the U.S., but no liquidity. So I guess that means that the whole idea of viewing market quality in terms of liquidity as volume is useless. So if you look at volume, you say volumes are up, that doesn't necessarily mean that liquidity is up because that's the feedback that we're getting. Well, if that's not liquidity, then what is? People say, well, posted orders are liquidity. That's a great sign of market quality. The more lit orders, the better. Well, we also have the exact same feedback by the same exact groups at the exact same time saying, by the way, too many lit orders in the market that are being canceled too fast. So depending on your perspective, you're going to have a different definition of market quality. I can go on for hours, but again, the Zen and the Automotive Cycle Maintenance tells me I should not think too hard about this, but except to leave you with just the realization that there are so many different measures and that the more time we spend on the measures, the easier the decisions become. The more time we spend on the decisions and ignore the measures, the more we make a decision, then we change our mind, then we make another decision, we change our mind again.
Just two views on market quality. There's a commercial aspect to market quality, and that's based on the user, and Chris talked about that. And then there's the public policy aspect. And the public policy aspect almost has to divorce itself from the commercial aspect so you don't pick winners and losers in that debate. And that's, I think, one thing that the regulators, quite frankly, will probably struggle with because there's a lot of self-interest in the market. We're all driven by the economics of our businesses. And as a result, good public policy to us is tied to good commercial policy. And the regulators somehow have to divorce those two when being the independent arbitrator. That's one. And then two is, in terms of market quality, when I just take a market view on it, we think about the highly interconnected and complex market, and we think about things like resiliency, redundancy, single point of failure. It's probably not the first thing that comes to mind when you think about market quality because, as Susan said, she's thinking about fairness, she's thinking about cost efficiency, competitiveness in the market. But to each constituent in the market, we probably think about it differently. So from our perspective, we look at it and say, how can we add to market quality? We can make sure there's no single point of failures from a market perspective, there's resiliency, redundancy. We're a technology company. So we got to make sure that any software we put out there doesn't compromise market integrity. And a lot of us don't think of ourselves as technology companies, but we are. And I think that's important to this. And then the final aspect is something I saw in Hong Kong, where the Hong Kong regulator put something out for proposal where they said for the buy side, they're going to have to attest to the fact that they actually know what they're using when they're using smart order routing or algorithms from broker-dealers. And this, the buy side didn't like this very much. What do you mean we have to know exactly how this thing works and the way it works through the entire market? And for the Hong Kong regulator, that was a metric of market quality. You must understand what you're using and how you're using it and the potential impact it will have on the market. So I think there are lessons out there. I think there's things you can take a look at, and I think each one of us will measure it differently. But the key is just trying to divorce the commercial from the good public policy perspective.
And I think what we're learning as we go along in building our analytics capability is that you can measure different aspects of measures of market quality, bid-ask spreads, depth, et cetera, volatility. But how do you sort of combine those into some picture that draws some conclusion when that picture may mean different things to different people. One of those measures may be more important to one group than another. So it's a challenge, and to a certain extent, I think it's we need to be careful not to draw too much in the way of conclusion, but to do more of what we're doing now and starting to put information out there and hearing people's views.
I think going back to Susan Howard's conversation this morning, which was great, by the way, certainly the confident participation of investors, that's very important. Others on the panel, and I would certainly agree with this statement, certainly you need intermediation. You need some form of intermediation. Markets, secondary markets, do not operate well without some form of intermediation. And then, you know, that's really, I think, when, you know, views start to diverge as to the nature of that and in the measures, of course. Some focus on speed, some focus on spread. Price discovery and market efficiency is one I hear a lot, although I don't hear a whole lot of people up on panels talking about how they measure it. Academics do have ways to measure market efficiency. We've done some research in that area, which I think a few people have seen, so I won't go into it in any big detail, but certainly intraday volatility, transitory volatility can be seen as an issue. And I think that, you know, we really need to start exploring, how to separate those issues. Obviously, at the end of the day, it's the job of the regulator to, as others have said, arbitrate between everybody, you know, lobbying mm-hmm. for their commercial interests, what is best for the market.
Yeah, and I think the approach we've all taken as regulators that was discussed this morning is to really try and stick to the principles. Right? If we're comfortable that we put the right principles in place, then stop there. Because it gets a little messy if you go beyond that point. But we need to monitor and understand what's happening. So you made a good segue, Stephen, into the next topic on intermediation. I guess I'll ask in a very simplistic way, but what is HFT anyway? I mean, we all know we've had this debate, but I think it's important to get that on the table because, as Victoria tried to stress in the presentation, we don't see HFT as an entity or even a strategy. It's just a type of activity, and we know from our data that the activity represented in that study group is not firms like Chris's or TradeBot necessarily alone. There's a lot of dealer activity, proprietary trading, some client activity that are using dealers' algos and whatnot, hedge funds, et cetera. There's a whole variety, as we know, going on out there, and I think the public perception of what HFT is vastly different from what it really is. And so, you know, my question is, what is it? And really, should we really be distinguishing the type of trading that's happening today from some very long-standing principles? You know, you can think of many examples around where traders in the past have found some way to gain an advantage. And my favorite example is the Scotia trader with the plaid jacket on the trading floor. I'm dating myself because I saw him a lot in the day. And they developed a sign language so that the post clerk could get the message to the floor trader quicker than anyone else. So, you know, that was an advantage that was accepted at the time. So if we look back through time, there's lots of advantages that people have developed, competitive advantages that have been accepted. And yet now, where the advantage is gained through the use of technology, there's less comfort with that concept. So another double question: what is HFT, and should we be treating this type of activity any differently than other forms of trading in the past? Anyone?
Yeah, I'll try. All I know is I'm hot and stabilizing, so I think the report's done. Look, HFT, I've done a number of presentations where, you know, I've tried to define HFT, and I end up putting on the PowerPoint just a picture of a really nerdy guy with a pocket protector and thick glasses, and I said, that's HFT. If you see this guy, he's an HFT. It's just really hard to define. I do believe HFT is a strategy, right, because it can come in any form of legal entity. It can be sitting inside a hedge fund. It can be sitting inside a prop trading firm. It can be sitting inside a bank. So HFT, to me, is a strategy that is deployed, much like a car on a highway. a very fast-moving car. You have different types of drivers that sit in behind the wheel. So the question is that the ability to deploy this type of activity on the market, regardless of the legal entity that it sits in, do we need to regulate that activity, or do we have to define it and then regulate it? And I've always been of the view is I don't care what form you come into the market. We need to regulate you regardless of the legal entity you sit in. And trying to define behaviors and put this into a bucket, we spend a lot of time reaching a definition that in another month or another week or another year becomes meaningless. So I think the challenge of trying to define this activity, I'd rather spend time in let's regulate the activity. Let's see what is appropriate and not and inappropriate, and try and regulate and incent behaviors. And so the definition of HFT will just continue to be elusive. There are firms that, you know, my firm, I think, will satisfy everyone's definition of HFT. But funny, we're an electronic market maker. We're registered in all these markets. We trade, you know, less than penny increments. To do that without a computer is absurd. So we trade with a computer. We make markets with a computer. Guess what? You're a market maker, and in a modern market, you're an HFT. So it's just, you know, does it matter that we have to be defined? I mean, it matters that I'm defined as hot, but not HFT.
Yeah.
So I just think it's an effort that we get to the end of, and it's fairly meaningless, and we're still back to let's regulate the behavior. Let's regulate the driver, make sure they're licensed because they have this impressive tool, and let's make sure they're behaving correctly when they're driving down the highway.
Yeah. I think it really is unfortunate that a label was attached in the first place. I used to say that about dark pools. You know, it's too bad. It sounds so sinister. But it stuck, and it's there. And the same with HFT. And so that's really what I'm asking is, you know, should we be focusing in on this thing, whatever that you think that thing is, or is it just a part of the fabric of the markets? Stephen, you really look like you want to say something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important to understand certainly the different types of activity that are HFT. As others have pointed out, there are different types of activities that can certainly sit within different entities. You know, you do have to get down to that granularity in the discussion of understanding the different roles, and understanding the role that speed plays, I think, is an important part of that, co-location and things of that nature. And I don't think that we should start, you know, necessarily from the point of saying HFT good, bad. That's the worst place to start, because probably within HFT there is good and bad, almost certainly, arguably probably more good than bad. So you really have to understand, and then there's, you know, the notion, the legal notion. As a regulator, you have to think of the legal notion of intent. Was there an intent to be bad, or, interestingly, is there a collective, you know, way that HFTs interact together that cause bad, you know, results in the marketplace? I think that's definitely a possibility as well, that there's a group dynamic going on that, you know, isn't an intent-based situation.
Just to provide also a bit of context on that, in terms of good or bad, or what are HFTs, so thinking about just the U.S. market, and we can talk about other markets, is you had these intermediaries, and they were called specialists. And then the electronification of the market happened, decimalization happened, and a number of rule changes came about, and those individuals were phased out. New intermediaries came into the market. And those intermediaries were in their infancy stages in the early days, and they're still trying to figure out how that evolves through the market. And as Chris said, he's, you know, now considered an electronic market maker, or a DMM. And I think the discussion now needs to go to what's the balancing act between what intermediaries provide the market, what are the privileges they receive, what are the obligations they have in a market, how do we sort of mature from where we've gotten to over the last 6-7 years from the nascent stages of taking out the specialists. And this is not a comparison of are we better off today than we were 10 years ago. That's not the question. Because sometimes that's the rhetoric in terms of that's why today is okay or yesterday wasn't okay. The bigger question is, as these electronic market makers, intermediaries, HFTs, progress and evolve, what's the right balancing act? And markets have a big role to play, and I have to be honest, as a market, I think a lot of us struggle with how we make money and what the commercial model is in the new world. In the specialist world, in the old world, it was very obvious. It was understood, well understood. Now that unbundling or the breaking of all those fees that we sort of put together in an execution fee now is represented in, you know, connectivity fees, data fees, listing fees, and some other panelists mentioned it. So I think exchanges are trying to figure it out. I think there needs to be a balance between the privileges and obligations, but we are going through a transitionary stage, and you're seeing this, and we see it in Asia, by the way, quite a bit in terms of how they're transitioning, even in markets which are not multi-market environments. Just electronification itself is having a profound effect on those markets and how they operate. So it's a phase where we have to improve ourselves. We shouldn't just compare ourselves to the past or look at what is the definition of what's happening today. Think about it in the instance of with make or take or anything else. Where do we want to get to? What is a healthy environment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have I don't know if I can define HFT, but I tend to try to define two different classes of market participant, of which you can either say one entire is just HFT, or you can segment that further. I actually think it's angels on the head of a pin type of debate. But if you just parse letters, so I take it backwards, trading. You have to trade. So you can't be an HFT, you actually don't trade. So how are you trading? You're trading with a high frequency. What does that actually mean? Most people think that means you trade fast. That's wrong. Otherwise, they wouldn't call it high-frequency trading. They'd call it something different. The concept of a frequency means you go one way, you go the other. It's like a wave, up, down, left, right, back and forth. So a high-frequency trader, I think by my definition, is someone who tends to trade first one way and then the other way, in contrast with a party that says, actually, I pretty much just trade one way for a given stock. Now, how fast is fast? A long-term investor, I might buy a stock. I don't have the SEC. I don't buy anything. But someone might buy a stock, and then 3 years later, they sell the stock, and then they buy a different stock. Probably we wouldn't call that high frequency. That's 3 years, a really long holding period. So I think we sort of have the idea that there's an investor community out there that buys and sells for some sort of a long-term appreciation, and perhaps they're buying and selling to do something as simple as mechanically following an index, or they're stock picking, or anywhere in between. Then you have a whole host of parties who are not buying for the economic incentive of owning the company, but are responding to the fact that there's trading that's going on. So they determine whether or not they want to buy or sell something based on what's going on right now in the market, not necessarily for the economic incentive of holding those companies. And they tend to first go long, and maybe they build up some long positions, and they go short. It's incorrect to say all HFTs go home completely flat, just as it's incorrect to say all market makers go home completely flat. But I think if you make that bifurcation, you have one community, and then you have the other community that's more responding. In a continuous market, which is what we have today, because investors want a continuous market, their choice, they want that, that's what they get, there is not enough investor activity to support a continuous market with just investors. The market falls apart if you only have people who want to buy and hold and sell. You have to have intermediaries. That's been the case forever. Over the years, there has been an increased electronification, it's a made-up word, but electronification of the markets. Investors use that. Retail investors use that. Institutional investors use that. And intermediaries use that. So they all use algos. Everybody uses computers. I use computers. I didn't used to use computers because we used to have punch cards when I first started all of this. So when defining an HFT as someone who uses low latency or high technology, I actually think those are destructive definitions because an investor does the exact same thing, or should be, if they want to actually be a good investor. If you're sitting in the middle of your living room and you buy one share or 100 shares of a stock and you hit go, the amount of technology that's being used to execute that trade far exceeds the amount of technology than any HFT actually has. It's a vast network of information that allows someone to buy a simple retail trade. So I guess if we use technology, then grandma who buys 100 shares of Microsoft, they're an HFT. And that's just silly. That's a perverse definition. So I just tend to think about it as HFT is the natural consequence of what intermediaries are when you add in the same technology that we use everywhere else in the market. Investors use those same technologies, but wouldn't necessarily classify them as HFT.
So
Thank you for the layup. We didn't plan this, but I brought up this slide because as part of the Equitas proposal, it was suggested that the SME or short marking exempt marker would be used as a good proxy for some form of HFT. And I think it's a notion that a lot of people kind of assume there's this one-for-one correlation between the two. And so just to reiterate, the SME marker is really intended for non-directional trading, so the type of stuff that you talked about, Greg. Those entities, accounts, users, et cetera, traders that go home or try to go home flat at the end of the day. So that's what that marker is being used to identify in our market. And what this slide showed is that not all SME are HFT, at least by our definition, right? So the question is twofold. One is, who are the other SMEs if they don't fit our definition? And I think the other point that is not shown in these stats, but is true as well, is not all HFT is SME, right? So there are strategies being executed by firms that do a lot of non-directional trading that are in fact directional in nature as well. And Chris, I'm not asking you to tell us about your strategies per se. You can just talk it in a generic sense, but you're obviously aware of the strategies that are being deployed out there. What kinds of strategies are HFT shops doing beyond the non-directional?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about our strategies, not in great detail, but but we are not a non-directional shop by definition. We trade at spread, attempt to trade spread. We'll trade products like ETFs and futures and across many different asset classes and across continents as well. So we do interlisted, ADRs, you name it. And it's very non-directional. There are obviously a variety of different directional strategies that look a lot like a buy-side algo, ironically, where it's executing just shorter holding periods than executing into a position, holding it. So there are out there of the world of, I don't know anyone who's trading them because we don't know. You know, typically HFTs don't share strategies with other HFTs.
I thought that's what you and Andy were doing.
Yeah, well, Andy gave me all his stuff.
Did
so,
he? Yeah.
And he's hot too.
he knew that a year ago. Yeah.
So there are directional based strategies. There are people who, I call them the modern version of a chartist, right? The stock is moving, and their computer has a signal, and that signal tells the computer that it needs to take a position. And it takes a position based on what it sees, and it's a signal-based strategy. And those, I don't know, you know, I always wrestle with this, are they appropriate? You know, are they really adding some form of liquidity, or are they just, you know, predators sitting inside the market? And I don't know the answer to it, because there's some forms, if they hold for a day, then I guess they're not a predator. They just made an investment decision. If they hold for a microsecond, maybe they're a predator. I just don't know the answer. I don't know what the holding period for that type of strategy is, but I know it exists. I think the large majority of the activity that we see, and some of your passive numbers reflect that, is people using computers to be non-directional to capture spread, either the spread of an individual stock, the spread between multiple instruments, an ETF to the components, or spreads between interlisted trading in the U.S., trading in Canada. So there are probably inappropriate means of using computers, but I think the large majority of people in the space are attempting to capture very finite opportunity, and you only can do that with a computer given mm-hmm. the level of volumes and the level of activity.
Yeah. Does anyone have a view on this slide?
I'd like to take a crack at it.
Sure.
Most definitely, I think that in looking at the IIROC data, and we're not going to talk about it in a whole lot of detail because we're not drawing conclusions because it's very preliminary.
Mm-hmm.
However,
very confined.
Thank you. However, I'll give you a scenario. If you're an ETF market maker, and you are marking yourself SME, and say you have two separate IDs. One ID is for your actual posting activity, and the other ID is for your hedging activity. Then one would appear hot or your definition of HFT, and the other would not. So I think that, you know, in looking at the data today, that's exactly why, to your point, it is very important to recognize how preliminary this data is.
That was very politically correct, Steve.
Thank you.
Last month at the SEC, we released a paper as part of a new website. One of the papers that we did was a literature review, and we started with market fragmentation, both lit and dark, though the majority of papers that tend to be written are more on the dark side than on the lit markets. See, I fell into the trap, the dark side. It's more on the unlit portion of the markets. And it's not conclusory. We're not saying that this is good or this is bad. It's really just here's all the papers that have been out there over the past 5 years, and here's where they agree, here's where they disagree, and we'd love to get comment and focus on that. The idea of doing literature review seems to have caught on, and we're going to be doing a lot more. The next one that we're actually working on now is literature review of HFT broadly. So any article that actually had like the letters HFT in the title or high speed, something like that. And what we have found is the selection criteria that's used to determine whether or not someone's HFT has a tremendous impact on what their results are. And everybody uses something differently. In fact, we even were able to find papers by the same authors who changed their view. And here's a subsequent paper, and we actually amended our definition of what we want to be in or what we want to be out, and then to get a different conclusion based on that. So what I think is interesting about that is not just one could take a negative view of that and say, see, it doesn't, you can't really gain anything because the classification matters. But actually, I take the opposite, which is this is actually extremely instructive because you can say for these types of firms that meet these criteria, or this type of trading that meets this criteria, this is the effect of that type of thing, without actually having to say, well, is that HFT or not HFT? Who cares? I don't know if your criteria is HFT, but you've laid it out. It's very, very clear. You said you have to be hot, you have to have this percentages and that percentages, and that's something that you can then measure those effects of. Someone else can have a different set of criteria. They'll come up with different effects.
Yeah, good point. Anything, Tom?
I just think we have too many acronyms.
We do.
I think this
industry has more than most industries.
It's a highly complex industry because we have too many acronyms. But the moment you tie economic incentives to acronyms, or you say SME equals HFT, is when I become concerned, because then I think people will look to circumvent what an SME is. So it's a definition today. It's a data point today. And to the extent that a SME means something else tomorrow in terms of economic incentives, guess what? The HFT percentage that represents SME or vice versa may increase, decrease in terms of how people will look at those definitions. So using it for measurement purposes, using it to better understand the market, that's great. Positive feedback loop, that's great. Once you tie it to economic incentives and say, well, if you're defined this way, which is slightly arbitrary, and here are the economic incentives associated with it, then guess what? That definition is tends to fall apart.
Yeah, and I do think it's important, and we recognize that IROC, it's important for us to really very closely monitor for compliance with the rule and the intent of the rule for marking SME. So those situations where, you know, account activity is being split up into two IDs, so one is SME and one is not, for example, that's clearly not the intent of the rule, so we need to be keeping an eye for that kind of thing and addressing it. If that's
that.
What we're seeing. Good.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, I don't do that. Although I might go back and take off the whole SME marker. What a terrible label to be a SME.
I know.
You're a SME. You're hot or you're SME?
I want to be a SME.
What do you want to be, a SME or hot?
SME or a schmo.
It's terrible.
SME or a schmo. Andy, I know you have a question, but I'm going to suggest, we talked about it prior, we're going to leave plenty of time at the end for questions if we could, just so we can get through some of the main topics.
Question. We saw the numbers of HFT that are SME, but we didn't see the reverse percentage. How much of HFT is SME?
Well, as Victoria would say, we'll cover that in our next phase. Yeah, no, it's not readily available right now, but it's again, there's so much that we need to look at, and this is just the tip of the iceberg here today. So that's definitely something we want to understand as well. But I brought this up because I think The slide on stabilizing trades, which we recognize is really just one part of the picture. It's the trade itself and whether or not it causes a downtick, for example. The group in talking about this, you know, pointed out the fact that to truly measure whether a trade is stabilizing or destabilizing, you need to look at the reaction by the market following that trade for some, you know, various periods of time. So we need to do that. So we can't take that slide as sort of the gospel around stabilizing and destabilizing trades, but it is interesting. When you couple that with this data, which I found interesting, I'm getting old, but if you look at the percentage, this shows the percentage of selling on a downtick across all market participants. And what is that blue line showing? 15%? Between 10 and 15% of activity by all participants is selling on a downtick. And then you look at the HFT percentage. This is the TSX listed graph. That percentage is much lower. So what I took out of it was HFT sell on a downtick less on average as a portion of their total trading than the rest of the market, including them, than on the market as a whole. What do we make of that? Because I know the public perception, certainly in the venture market, would say that HFTs are the culprits behind all selling on a downtick.
Well, their definition of an HFT may be different than your definition.
Maybe.
And again, I think that's so. This is the first time I saw this data, like half an hour ago. So I have no idea what a SME was. So now I've learned something new.
Don't
use
that US.
If my understanding is if you have HFT, if one of the criteria is that you have to have a high order to trade ratio, and if you have a low order to trade ratio, then you're by definition not in this. Then there will be parties that are purely aggressive. So you'll have someone who says, all I do is trade all day long. I have never posted a limit order in my life. I just take liquidity. I would imagine that some of those folks would be taking liquidity and going short, taking liquidity and going long, might also have SME markers. So if someone says, I think HFT should have, you know, maybe they would be short a lot, it might be that in their universe they're including those. And that's the one that they're focusing on. Your universe doesn't. So I think this gets back to what the results show is that for your selection criteria, that class of activity has less SME markers than the non-class of those. That doesn't make a good headline. No one's going to write that in the press. This class of activities has different SME markers than another class of activities. But as a regulator, I think that's the challenge that we both have.
But just to clarify, I think this data is really just showing that the downticking activity, and I don't know about the audience, but I think it is a public perception that HFT or trading is behind a lot of that activity. When in fact, and you know, I think IIROC years ago came to the conclusion, and as all regulators around the world did, that short selling in general and the ability to decide that I think the price of this stock should go down for whatever your reason is a necessary part of the ecosystem of the markets.
So I think we talked about in looking at this data and our sort of pre-panel discussions that this is what you're talking about is downtick by a venue, and it's the trade that downticked, right? So what, for example, this doesn't cover is consumption of liquidity at a particular price increment. Mm-hmm. So, again, this is another one of those things where I think we need to be careful about drawing conclusions based upon this first crack mm-hmm. of the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
And I'll just take a step back in terms of the data, and can I, if it's okay, go on a tangent, which is to say, so having this data allows you to measure the efficacy of certain changes. Or, as somebody else said, I think it might have been Howard, who said, not all innovation is net positive. So the ability to measure innovation, the ability to measure change, and that's what we're looking at now is like the starting point of that. So these are just data points that allow you to measure the efficacy of a change or the net benefit of innovation. And it was, I read something from Bill Gates that said Microsoft, the key to their innovation before they were really stagnant for the last 20 years, but the key to their innovation was measurement, being able to measure. So if you can measure and you know what you're measuring for, then you can innovate. If you can't, then you really can't say that you've innovated because you don't know what the net impact has been. So if we can start to use this data, put it in the right people's hand to understand, once again, the efficacy and measure innovation and figure out, well, this piece of innovation or this change isn't healthy for the market, that's great. My only other thought is the next thing you should call something is something like Ninja, something cool, like Ninja.
Yeah, good
you know.
Idea. Yeah. Yeah, it's too bad we're leaving hot behind us, too.
Yeah.
Can I could not possibly agree any stronger. And that actually is the wave of the future. Traditionally, regulation is folks do something, and then they go back and they try to justify with data or try to even measure the effect after. Putting out data without actually saying, because we did a lot of data at the SEC. We launched this whole thing, and reporters are coming. So what does this mean? What's your objective? I said the objective was to put data out there. Yeah, but you're obviously trying to show something. No, we're actually not trying to show something. We're trying to put data out there about a whole bunch of different things. So first, we can measure how it changes over time. And then if someone ever says, we don't like that number, we should go do something that raises it or lowers it, we'll actually know what the number is before we start the project. And then if the number goes down when we thought it would go up, we can say, obviously, whatever we did didn't work. And people can argue about whether or not the number should even go up or go down. But absent putting out information, you can't really start that process. And I think that's a sort of a wave of the future in regulation to get information out to the public.
Yeah. Want to switch gears just a little bit, get a little bit more down into the weeds on HFT and the notion of what is a predatory strategy. And coupled with that, are predatory strategies, however you want to define them, should they be against the rules? IROC, as we said earlier, we put a line in the sand where we said these things are bad. These are manipulation in our view. And we looked at it from the point of view of the rule itself, which is based on very simple, basic principles that go back in time. But a lot of the rule itself requires proof of intent in some way. And, you know, a few of us had a discussion last night with some of the other regulators here in the room about potentially regulators moving away from this need to prove intent, because it is very difficult, no matter how good your data is, to have granular enough data and accurate enough data with very accurate timestamps down to the nanosecond to truly prove intent, to truly prove a certain strategy executed in a certain way. And so there's a notion being sort of bandied about, I believe in Europe, around this concept of recklessness, for lack of a better word. And whether regulators should be really looking at that. And you put any number of types of activity into that, but it sort of takes that line that we drew in the sand around what's, you know, clearly intentional manipulation to a different place where there's this sort of middle ground that you might call, Stephen, predatory. So let's talk a bit about, you know, what that middle zone is and should it be illegal?
So, I mean, there's intent. There's also lack of intent. And obviously, and this is, you know, where the debate gets interesting, is, you know, phantom liquidity or statistical front running or, you know, latency arbitrage, whatever you want to call it, is that intent? Well, the question was there an intent to trade? Some will say, and that's obviously an interesting part of the debate, was there an intent to trade for the 100, 100, 100, 100 that was, you know, scattered on various marketplaces? So I think that's interesting. The fact of the matter is that this is today's marketplace. That is the liquidity that's being provided today. And that's what I was alluding to earlier, is the collective behavior of HFTs to stand in, you know, markets moving, they see the market moving a nickel. Are they going to stand in the front of a freight train? Probably not. So they're probably going to try to cancel. They may try to go the other way. So, and is that a, you know, counterproductive group behavior, or is it a, you know, malicious behavior? That is the interesting question. That is, I think, the key question, or one of the key questions, certainly the regulators have to be asking themselves.
Well, we do ask that, but I'd like some answers today, actually.
No, please. I agree that it's very difficult to prove intent. There's been some cases around layering and spoofing that have been successful where a reasonable person would conclude that that behavior is not for the purpose of trading. So things like spoofing orders and but it's when you get away from the most obvious, the you know someone putting in very large size and then taking the other side and getting someone to gaming the market, and you move into just someone placing a lot of orders and messages, then it gets difficult. And then you're in this gray area, and the industry will always say, well, please give me some guidance. When you say reckless, what do you mean by reckless? How many orders is reckless? So we get into this whole debate of, you know, yeah, it would be nice to have reckless as a standard because when someone blows up their firm because they were reckless around their technology, that's reckless and that should be fined. And that's not behavior because it damages the rest of the industry. But when someone is trading a very active ETF, did they send too many messages? Well, tell me what the standard is and I'll meet the standard. So unfortunately, when you get out of this, you get into this gray area of recklessness, you start to be required as a regulator to start to define standards around recklessness. And we'll all meet them. We'll all then move to the side and say, okay, I'm not reckless. I'm SME with less recklessness. but that's the problem with recklessness. And I hear it in Europe all the time. I hear regulators talking about, well, this was reckless behavior. And we say, well, that's an ETF. I mean, it doesn't trade all that much, so we have to quote it a lot. It's a derivative. And so the standard is based on every symbol, every instrument that you trade, and it just becomes a very difficult debate.
Yeah, and
so no answer.
Yeah, I think our you know the OSC would agree on this that you know we really try to stay away from what are essentially prescriptive rules where there's a line that says it's okay if it's up to this point and not up to that point. So that's always the conundrum with regulation that we can't define it clearly. The industry would like clear definitions so they can stay on the right side of the line. But if we do that, we're opening up a new opportunity,
right.
Which is anything up to that line is perfectly acceptable, even if it's close, right? So, yeah.
Just in the spirit of collecting more data points, can we get the audience involved for just a second? And if you had to think about what worries you more about the market today, I'll pose this question. Would it be the predatory behavior or the complexity and maybe the negligence that occurs today in the market? So some of the more high-profile events that have happened either in the U.S. or elsewhere, it may not be predatory, but they were introducing new software. The new software didn't work as it should. Well, market integrity has been compromised. So if we could ask the question for data points for you, for regulators, what worries you more, predatory behavior or complexity or negligence? And just let's start with predatory behavior. Anybody? One guy in the back.
Wow.
Good guy.
I think you're giving your point.
Is everybody else then? So that, I'm just making the point of we should then talk about
yeah.
what's most germane to people. So complexity and negligence, just for.
They're not worried at all. How
many people are just really happy?
That's good.
Yeah. Sorry, look, Peter's happy, I can see. He's smiling all the time.
Tal, can I have one
yeah.
more? What about the incentives baked into the ecosystem, effectively?
It's
the trading ecosystem collectively and the incentives that are there.
Such as? I think we need a little more definition around the incentives.
Maker so, taker, for example.
Okay, mm-hmm. yeah. Show of hands. Yeah, so, well, there's still a lot of very happy people that don't worry about anything. In
the yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, you bring up a good point, and it's worth noting when we talk about recklessness. That can, as we said, it can mean any number of things, right? The electronic trading rules address a certain form of recklessness, right? They really do get at those the kind of thing you're talking about, Tal. The mayhem that's caused in the market because you know there was a software glitch or there wasn't a filter in place to check. You know, the checks and balances weren't there, so. So that's one thing I think it's really important that we're working on and other regulators around the world on putting those checks and balances in so that when that stuff happens, because you're never going to prevent it from happening, we can all stop, take a breath, and as Susan pointed out this morning, at all levels, we're at least dealing with it quickly and efficiently. So that, I think, can bring confidence to a lot of investors that those sorts of things, theoretically, shouldn't happen as often going forward. Right?
Yeah, well, just to give you a global view, our view, because we operate in Asia and other places, is regulators are most concerned about the complexity and negligence. Those are where the rules are coming out, like ETR, but that's where most of what we've seen, the regulatory focus has been. Now, Europe is sort of worried about everything. So the guy in the back, you should go to Europe. And I think the other part of it is, if you're going to look for market manipulation, that requires a continual investment in technology, because these techniques over time change. So we operate an exchange in Australia. We're supposed to supervise our members, and we do. And what we find is we have to continually invest in the technology required to monitor our market in a proficient way. And so there's something underlying there that you have to understand. If you want to be on top of it, everybody knows what market manipulation looks like. It hasn't changed in a long time, but the techniques, as others have said, and the methods have changed. So it just requires that continual education and investment in technology or resources to find it out. Where on the other side of complexity and negligence, you can deal with it through rules more effectively.
Right. One
of the things that I worry about a lot is the intersection of these, but mostly it's the confusion between those. Because, and I've said this many times before, if you don't make the right diagnosis, you're not going to make the right prognosis. So I don't know if you like feed a cold, starve a fever. I don't know. My grandmother used to tell me these things. But if you did the wrong one, you're really in trouble. So you need to get the right diagnosis. And one of the things that we hear a lot is some sort of confusion between a lot of the technology issues and a lot of the predatory nature, market manipulation, issues around HFT, no matter how that's defined. And it's funny because when you actually look at what happens, the last large event that we had that was due to complexity and that had any implication with regards to high-frequency trading or algorithms was the May 6, 2010 flash crash. There has been nothing in the U.S., maybe in the U.S., I don't know, but just in the U.S. since then that has actually related to those types of things. Every other large-scale technology issue that has happened has been root-cause technology, not related to the types of things that people write about and talk about all the time, not even related to the complexity of the market. That drives me crazy when someone says there was a problem with an IPO. Now you can actually say which one, because the problem with two IPOs over the last few years. What does the problem of a computer matching engine having a problem in its software with an IPO have to do with the fact that there are 15 markets? You can have 5,000 markets. If that complexity has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not someone has a bug in their IPO engine. So the complexity of the markets and having many, many different venues, those are really great conversations. They have huge impacts on the market. But when people assign that complexity and say, see, you have all this complexity, this is the issue that we have. You know, an IPO doesn't work right. There's no connection between those two things. So I don't know what the diagnosis is. So, yes, I guess if we only had only three exchanges instead of 12 exchanges, I guess those three exchanges would roll out their software better or differently? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. So I get worried when folks assign the wrong causes for things. So we spend a lot of time just trying to figure out what's the actual cause, because and we respond. So we respond with things like proposed Reg SCI, which has to do with technology and technology standards. It doesn't actually have to do with, well, what if you're a high-frequency trader? That actually has to be addressed in a different way.
Yeah. And a classic example of that was the association of HFT with the night trading incident, for example.
Right, and I'd say there's probably one out of 1,000 retail investors that understand the difference between those two. The other 999 don't understand that at all. In fact, the vast majority of retail investors believe that their orders go directly to exchanges and compete with high-frequency trading firms who co-locate. And we hear that a lot. It's like, well, you know, how can I possibly buy 100 shares of Microsoft? I can't win. I can't compete against Chris. Don't worry about it. That's the last thing that a retail investor should ever be worried about, because those orders don't even interact with each other. So it's
to a lot of point this morning about segregation. Yeah, in the U.S. markets, for sure. Yeah. Switching gears a little bit, I think one of the concerns that we have as regulators, or we wonder about at least, is whether or not there's still a place for traditional market making. And just before we started, someone said, well, what is that? What is market making? It means different things to different people. What I mean by it, my question is, the specialist or in Canada, the registered trader role. So the guy who, in your example, Stephen, you know, when it's an HFT going to stand there and get run over by a freight train, the guy who's supposed to actually let himself get run over by the freight train, right? Take one for the team. Is it realistic to think that there could even be market makers that perform that kind of function anymore, or is that a bygone notion?
I think you could have that sort of an activity. When I look at things, I would think of, you know, stat arb players. Call, you know, I buy it here, I sell it here. Not for 100 shares or 1,000 shares, right? I mean, Chris, you're meeting some sorts of obligations on NYSE, right? I mean, I think that it is absolutely possible, and I think that we do need to think about the benefits of a system that relies on 20 or 30 or 40 individual actors all acting out of self-interest and no obligations versus, you know, responsible market makers that do have rights and obligations. I do think that we need to have that debate.
Well, and I guess a fair question is, with the controls, for example, that we have in place, and very shortly we'll be, proposing some expansion of the single stock circuit breaker program, for example, with single stock circuit breakers in place, I guess we could ask the question, do we need a market maker to stabilize, or do we just let the market sort of take its course, knowing that in many cases a market maker may, at the end of the day, they do want to live, right? They want to survive, right? So they may get out of the way of that train despite their obligations. So, is it realistic to expect someone to stand in there and play that role, and especially in light of the fact that we do have a certain level of control that stops it from sort of, you know, moving too far too fast?
Yeah, I'll try and respond. I think we have to look at, we talk about investor segmentation and trading segmentation, but really we have to segment our instruments, right? The most liquid instruments probably don't need a market maker, but they may need a market maker several seconds throughout the day. But they're very liquid, and so giving benefits to a market maker in the most liquid instruments is probably not a good trade for the overall market. But then as you go out that liquidity curve and you move down to the less liquid, that trade several times a month, maybe even once a month, and there's someone posting a quote taking risk, then you have to extend some benefit to that market maker. And what we've done globally, this is globally, every market has done it, we've basically collapsed the most liquid, the incentives for liquidity providers in the most liquid, to the tune of billions of dollars of savings. Think of decimalization. We've taken out any advantages that the most liquid intermediaries have, and we left the less liquid without any benefits left. So we do have these market maker obligations here and there around the planet. They're not that strong. They don't provide a lot of, no one's going to stand in front of the moving train. They may take a couple nicks on the way down. The real question is, how do we really want to return to the old, what was called the specialist subsidization model? They basically had unfair rents at the high liquid level that subsidized their willingness to take the hit in the less liquid names. And so I don't know how we get back to a place where market makers have real, I want market makers to have obligations. We're always proponents of obligations. I just don't know the exchange of benefit, having some benefit in return for those market maker obligations versus who is really going to catch that falling knife. I don't know anyone who, number one, should have the capital to just stand in front of the train, and I don't know anyone that, even if they have obligations, won't waive all their obligations and walk away, which happened in the 87 crash and in other events throughout the course of history, clear market maker obligations, and they walked away in that event. Or they stopped answering the phones, or they shut down their systems. There's a lot of different examples. So it's a difficult challenge. And one thing I keep coming back to you know, if you think about maker taker, some people argue, well, the rebate's a little bit of a a market maker benefit. I don't buy that. There's no exchange of obligation with that. I do think there are minimum levels of obligations that we, as active traders, sitting on a bid, I have a privilege of sitting on a bid, sitting on an offer. I should have obligations with respect to being at the best bid, at the best offer, and then some level of price depth. I always think of price depth as supporting a stock. So when that order comes ripping through several markets, I am at risk. I have several levels of depth there, and I've sustained some amount of that destabilizing event. And I think of those in very basic terms of market maker obligations. Now, what would the benefits be in return? That's where I struggle with. And do you need benefits in the most liquid? And can you subsidize somehow the less liquid? In terms of our DMM business on the floor, we're in 258 names of the probably the crappiest stocks you could find. They're the old Amex names, and it's not fun. It is literally not fun. We sometimes scratch our head and say, why are we doing this? Because there's stocks that trade once a day, and the benefit isn't there. So it's a struggle. It's a struggle, market maker obligations versus what product are we obligated in.
You're doing it, it's because you get the DMM obligations in the more liquid stocks. Is that
no,
is that fair?
No, we have no liquid
stocks. Why are you doing it then?
Someone asked us to do them a favor. Okay,
that's another topic. That's another topic.
I think it's tricky to think about the concept of market maker obligations in a vacuum. When if you go back years ago when you had specialists everywhere, et cetera, you also had different buy-side participants and different investors. They've moved on. They use different tools and techniques. Market making, I mean, we often talk about market structure as if it's somehow independent of the buy-side who use it and the products that they actually put on the markets. You can't pull these apart. So if I wanted to be a market maker, the first thing I would do is I would say, well, I'll place maybe some trades here at the bid and even more depth over here, because that's, you know, if it's going to bounce back, it's even better, and even more depth over here. But if it turns out that now because of algorithm trading, buy side never goes more than a tick deep because they have algorithms that say, I'm going to go at the NBBO and I'm going to wait for someone to meet me back at the NBBO. So post more at the NBBO and I'm willing to take you out. It was difficult to do that when you didn't use an execution algorithm. Now you have execution algorithms that I'd like to say play games, but that sounds very negative. That try to do the exact same thing that someone who is providing liquidity tries to do, which is figure out where things are going and not move the market away from me too fast. That's what execution algorithms are designed to do, and they're used all the time. So market making has to reflect not what we wish market making was, but what works in an environment where that's how everybody wants to use the market. So I don't know what the right answer is, but I do know that the dialogue independent of how to think about the people who are using the market doesn't make a lot of sense, because mm-hmm. otherwise you'll wind up with rules that just don't work at all for the way that people want to use the markets today.
I don't want to leave today without at least touching on dark liquidity. We did say we'd talk about that as well. We didn't present much in the way of data, but one thing I must ask Tal is, how did Chi-X do it? Your market share of dark trading in Canada has gone up markedly since the change in the rules. Did you not see that?
We noticed.
Yeah?
We noticed. And some of it, I think, may be a consequence of the rule changes, but for us, the way we participate in the dark is through a mid-peg order type, and pretty much everybody in the audience would know how that works. And that's just become the convention after the meaningful price improvement rule. And so from that perspective, I think brokers were able to tune their algorithms and their price improvement capabilities around potentially midpoint. So that certainly has benefited us and probably others. So I wouldn't say just Chi-X benefited. Others have benefited, and you can see Match now has gotten back to the levels they were and maybe even higher at days from before the dark rules. So the only impact on the dark rules that we saw is there's one particular venue that went from 5% down to essentially zero. Mm-hmm. And that has been the impact from our perspective, a simplified view of what's happened. But I'm sure the data will probably tell us differently.
Well, and, you know, I think there was a slide, if I can find it quickly, on the DARC that showed the HFT participation before and after. And so does anyone have any thoughts on this? As Victoria pointed out, it's quite stable prior to the rule changes and dropped and continues to gradually decline since then. So it would appear that there was something about the trading in the DARC prior to the rules that was more attractive to HFT than now. And I think I know the answer, but why don't I ask some of you? Anyone have a thought?
I think the answer is fairly obvious. Mm-hmm. I think you alluded to the venue interest spread, obviously. You know, when you're only providing 10% price improvement as opposed to half the spread, that's a fairly significant change and a significant ask for an HFT to pay up half the spread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not surprised. That I think that is the answer. Would you agree, Chris?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a form of sub-penny.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd rather not pay the full spread.
Right. And but what I find interesting about this is that there was a notion prior to the rules going into place that we shouldn't change the rules because the dark pools were a haven or a refuge from HFT. So when, in fact, what these numbers show is HFT was far more active in the dark prior to the rules and is less active now. So I understand the argument that it was a refuge from HFT in the lit markets. But the reality is that HFT was, you know, as they had every right to do, taking advantage of a, you know, essentially a money-making opportunity in the dark. And so any comments on that? Any views? Do you think we did the right thing with the dark rules, I guess, is what we're getting at. Peter's not a fan. We heard that this morning. But do you think, are there any outstanding issues now that these rules have been in place for over a year? Are there things that need to change? Do we need to rethink those rules? As certainly as we go through our impact study, what should we be looking for? Are there concerns that we should be looking at?
I don't get the sense that you are going to rethink them, at least not initially at this point in time. You know, the fact of the matter is, and I know that Dave Panka was speaking earlier, I mean, there has been price improvement that has been lost. And, you know, I think that depending on who you are, 10% of the spread was meaningful or, you know, somewhat meaningful. Mm-hmm. And then obviously there's the cost aspect of things, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, both of those factors at play. I'm interested to hear. If you're going to rethink it soon, let me know.
Well, just to clarify, I mean, we're always willing to rethink, just as the OSC is rethinking OPR. The first step to get there is to do the impact study to understand, you know, what did this do to the market and to identify whether or not there are concerns. And if there are concerns, that necessitates a rethink of the rules. I think it goes without saying we wouldn't do that study if we didn't if we weren't willing to rethink.
So yeah. What if you get the likely conclusion, which is unched from a market quality perspective, really didn't make a big difference one way or the other? I guess is the question. If it's just about,
you're worse than a reporter.
No, I'm just I'm asking the question.
Well, yeah,
is there you know, if there's no real impact, discernible impact, because you're going to look at the data and it's going to be noisy data,
mm-hmm.
If you cannot determine that there was a benefit, are you willing to roll it back?
I would say certainly I can't answer that conclusively on behalf of all the regulators in the room, or I'll be killed when I get off the stage. But I would say my own personal view is that we did this, and I think Susan talked about it this morning, we felt that we were putting in place the right principles. And it goes back to our earlier discussion about principles, you know, sticking to the principles and letting the market fall where it may. And I think we do still fundamentally believe in those principles. And so if the results were neutral, it would be difficult to argue making a change. But if they're not neutral, then certainly we're open to it.
I would just add, I think in looking at the order protection rule, you really should look at this rule and the trade at rule, because they are intertwined. There are behaviors that are driven from the order protection rule into the dark so-called market. It's all about, to me, it's all about segmentation, client segmentation and trying to form segmentation. And Equitas is just another element to that discussion. I'm a big believer in segmentation. I think it's fine, even if it excludes us, because I think clients should be allowed to interact. At some point, segmentation gets too bad and too disruptive to price formation. But in the context of looking at order protection, you really should look at the dark rules as well.
Right. And so when you say there's sort of a point where segmentation is too much, is the U.S. market at that point, do you think? I'll ask the two of you, Greg, as well. And Greg, you're dealing with a number of similar but different issues, different concerns in the U.S. market. But is segmentation one that the SEC worries about?
Well, it's certainly a topic that we spend a lot of time on. We appreciate a lot of the work that you guys have done to allow us to observe what's happening in these things. So I'm glad I'm not in the middle seat today. It's a huge issue. An issue is the wrong word. It's a huge topic of a lot of open public discourse and debate about it. Again, one of the papers that we released last month specifically took a week of data. We try to pick a normal week. I think it was May 7th of 2012. And we pulled data from FINRA's OATS system, and it was about 3 billion records, and we assembled it all together to try to get a better understanding of exactly what the order flow looks like on registered ATS. So registered ATS, it's about 10 to 15% on that week for the market. Off exchange trading, high 30s. To 40%. So first thing gives you an idea of there's only one-third of off-exchange trading even occurs in an ATS. The other two-thirds occur either through an over-the-counter market maker or what we call broker-dealer to broker-dealer networks. But when we just looked at the ATS data, what we found is it looks like exchange data. It's all round lots, 100 shares, sometimes maybe a little bit larger. Sure, there's some block trades that are out there, but it's predominantly lots of orders flowing in, low order to trade ratio, so many orders go in that wind up never getting filled. Looks pretty much like it does on an exchange. So again, it's not to say that, so is that good or it's bad? It's just that information has never been out there before, and we just wanted to make sure that we start by providing information into that dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're running close to the end of the time, so if there's any questions from the audience, I think we should take some. Vanula, you are so reliable.
Well, that's my job.
Thank you. With respect to market making, I'm going to ask a provocative question here. At what point does the investor take responsibility and accept the consequences of their own diligence and or lack of due diligence with respect to trading in secondary markets, which is VISM?
I'll attempt to answer. I think we're at the period now where investors, institutional and maybe retail, spend all the time analyzing the instrument that they were investing in and not the market that they were investing through. And I think about this a lot in terms of the buy side, thinking about training their PM about the cost of executing a specific symbol and the difficulty of executing that symbol, and how that changes over time. So, you know, a symbol that's hard today may be even harder in a year from now because of the nature of liquidity and what's happening in that stock. So educating the PM about his investment decision into that stock and the cost of that investment decision and how difficult it is in our current market to get executed and what that entry cost is, and then there'll be an exit cost as well. So I think we do need to turn our attention more, and obviously the sell side is helping here and helping the buy side understand the cost of execution in certain symbols. Because I foresee it getting harder. I don't foresee a world where, you know, all this natural liquidity comes rushing back into the market and it's, you know, you can trade any stock at any time and it's really easy and frictionless. I see it as getting harder. I see the market as getting much more professional, much more sophisticated, more reactive, more volatile, if you want to call it that.
in the case of retail investors, so many of you Canadians in the room would know that recently IIROC is focused on stop loss orders. And I think in that case, there's a bit of that theme in there, except that what we found is the reason we've had these what we call mini flash crashes as a result of the stop loss orders is because those retail investors haven't been educated or don't really truly understand how it's going to work when it executes. So they have the misconception, and they're as shocked as everyone else by what happens. And so our thinking was that the broker in that case has a responsibility to make sure that it's clear or to put curbs into place to prevent investors from, you know, doing things that they shouldn't really want to do. And really our thinking is that once those controls are in place that, you know, we're going to take a harder line to those situations where there is no reason to say I didn't know it was going to happen. If those pieces are in fact in place, then you know, investors and dealers are making the choice as to how far they're willing to let that stock go down, how far they're willing to sell down.
Yeah, I mean, definitely pre-trade filtering of how you're engaging the market today. And I think, Chris, we've talked about this before. You know, the thin crust of liquidity that sits at the top of the book, you have to be, you know, when I look at the intraday volatility study that we did, 2007, 2008, when people were learning how to interact with an HFT market or just learning, it was higher. It's come down somewhat since, and I think that really you can attribute that to people starting to figure out how to engage an HFT market. So there, you know, to your point, there is a responsibility certainly on consumers of liquidity to think about how they're consuming liquidity. First of all, for their to the extent that it's an agency relationship for their clients, and then obviously at an extreme. In terms of single stock circuit breakers and whatnot, the responsibility of the market.
I think it's hard to characterize institutional investors as one category. I mean, they're extremely varied. So you'll find certain institutional investors will they have their own tools, they have their own technologies, they have their own systems to figure out what's best for them in terms of how they engage in the market. They may even make their own routing decisions. You have institutional investors who work with broker-dealers and say, you know, you do this for me. It's a service that many broker-dealers provide. And then they each have their own differences and nuances in how they do these things. So it's actually very, very varied. But I think as a general rule, there's definitely been a shift in how institutional investors think about accessing liquidity. You said something that was interesting. You said the thin crust of liquidity. Chris said. We don't see it. We've been looking at this data for quite some time, and when I show a screen, when I show somebody a screen, usually they're like, wow, that makes no sense. So the other day, someone from a large broker-dealer said, we were looking at something, and as you know, even in the most liquid stocks, at a trading at a penny, by the time you're out to like 2-3 cents, there's nothing there. It's just a thin crust. Well, boom, press a button, there's the order book. You go out 20 cents, massive, massive amounts of liquidity are sitting there. So there is visibly posted orders that are far, very far from the inside. The question is, what does it mean to say that the liquidity is there? If I want to access it by going 5 ticks in and it suddenly disappears, then that's one thing. But I'm not sure that anybody ever accesses it by saying, I will purposely go and pay 5 cents to get 100,000 shares in one clip. Instead, I'm going to pay 1 cent and get 20,000 shares. And now I'm going to wait until someone repopulates that. Or if they don't, now I'm going to go to the next tick. Well, now it's gone. And if you define that as, well, the liquidity wasn't there, it disappeared, then I think I'd push back a little and say, well, it depends on your actions. So where did it go? Is the person who is providing liquidity 2 cents away, are they saying, look, I'm willing to provide liquidity 2 cents away from the spread? Or are they saying, I'm willing to provide liquidity at $35.26, regardless of what you actually do? And I think traditionally, market makers are thinking about this in terms of just absolute prices, So they stand there, but the market has moved. People now think in terms of relative. So if you want to access liquidity and you want to pay for access and liquidity, there's a lot there. If you don't want to pay for it and you say, I'm going to inch up and see if I can get that, then it fades. So I think depending on what your definition of a crust is, you can either say, so it is a thin crust, because it fades immediately, or you can say, actually, it's not a thin crust. Actually, it's quite deep if you want access. There's no right answer, but there is a very big disconnect with the way people use the markets today, talking about professionals, use the markets today, and how people populate the order book. This is something that we had only discovered since we had Midas, because now we can see everything. And we find we're spending a lot of time on this. It's very, very fascinating, this disconnect.
And kudos to you with what you've done with Midas and the website that you've put up, by the way. Very impressive. Robert, did you have a question?
And Peter had a question.
And Peter.
On Club.
Can you give me some hockey tickets?
Yeah. I can't. It would be payment for order flow, Peter.
You need to explain that. Why don't you tell them who your boss is?
Thanks.
Thanks for putting him on the spot.
Yeah, someone related to Virtu bought a hockey team. How's that?
We'll leave it at that. Everyone's going to go back and Google now for sure.
And
right?
Buying,
they're doing it right now.
Buying hockey teams, by the way, is a great investment historically. Definitely in Florida.
Yeah.
It's really to attract all the Canadians into Florida. Watch hockey. There.
Well, all the old ones are there.
Yeah, it's an arbitrage. Yeah.
Anyway, poor Robert's been waiting patiently over here.
Chris knows about playing hockey in Florida, right, Chris?
Yeah.
A little street hockey game in Florida a few years ago.
Yeah.
Hey, I wanted to, it's interesting, for those who follow this globally, and I know you've been prepping for your panel both only a few hours ago, that the wonderful trilogue in Europe came to some sort of a conclusion on dark, on what to do about dark. You know, the trilogue being the commission, the council, and some other guys got together and argued for about 6 months. Anyway, the point is they decided that 8%, that's it for dark. You know, you can only trade up to 8% in the dark. So my question to the panel is does that make any sense? Do you want to comment on that? Should it be a percentage? At what point should regulators or should we all get concerned that there's too much dark for the good of the market? Mm. And is it a percent? Is it an absolute value? Any comments on this news?
So just to understand, because I haven't seen the news yet, when a market surpasses 8%, it can't be dark anymore? Is that a fair interpretation?
They're basically seeing that MiFID II will say that the maximum dark allowed by the rules, which flow out of MiFID II, will be 8% overall, 4% per market. You know, remains to be seen exactly. You put them in the penalty box, they go all lit. What flows down from that is separate. But the philosophy, the guiding philosophy we talked about here is 9% is bad. Look, 100% is probably bad. Any comments on, is that the right approach?
European market structure debate is flawed. It's just flawed. It's bad. It's politicized. It's not data-driven. It's driven partly because of country economics and thoughts about how capital markets should work it for their society, relative to how we think about it here or in parts of Asia. So I think just if you look at everything that's been discussed in Europe, and these gentlemen also very aware of it, whether it's a transaction tax or whether it's other constraints on the market, whether it's putting speed bumps or mandating speed bumps, things of that nature, I think they're just draconian. I don't know that they've been done with the best interest of the retail investor, the institutional investor. There was something out there that said no retail investor, no institutional investor wants this, but yet, or 14% of them, that was their number, want this. So why did they come out and do it? It wasn't driven by the data. It wasn't driven by the industry. So who drove that decision? Commissions and politicians and bureaucrats. And that is the issue with how the public policy debate is formed in Europe. So does it surprise me? Do I have an opinion on it? Other than to say they're going to have to continue to iterate, because I don't know what 8% means today versus tomorrow and what 8% in a very liquid name versus a non-liquid name means, and we're only going to find this out. But I'm not even sure they have the data or care to fund this information or understand what the impact should be. So we were talking about that before. Once again, we'll see what the efficacy of this change is, but the anecdotal data suggests that it's not going to be good.
I mean, I'll agree with Tal. And I'll go broader. I think Europe is flawed. So,
does that include the UK? Because our friends from the
UK. No,
FCA
not at all. UK is great. Okay. Love the UK. Yeah. Look, the one good thing is it won't be implemented for another 10 years. So we can talk about it for a while. I'm sympathetic on this one. I think unfortunately you have to pick something. You have to pick a number. You can't just say, hey, we have a policy that we should just have dark, but as soon as we get uncomfortable, it should be light. And the SEC is guilty of this. They have Reg ATS that picked a percentage that you have to suddenly convert to display. So I just think it's a hard debate. But I do agree with Tal. I'm very concerned about the decisions being driven in Europe, not by hard evidence, not by good commentary process, just being discussed and coming to these conclusions and being driven by some politicians screaming about something that they have no idea about.
Well, that's an interesting way to end the day. And I think I should just add that, clearly it's not the way we think and the way we in Canada approach regulation. And on the dark rules, again, we thought the principle was right. And the essential principle there is that as long as you're willing to give meaningful price improvement, knock yourself out. We know there's a place for dark. As long as it's done appropriately and for the right reasons, then it should coexist with the lit markets to whatever level makes sense, wherever it falls. So on that note, I want to thank everyone. I want to thank the panel members here and all the panel members and speakers today. I think this is... In my view, I hope it's been enlightening for us. It's been a very good, constructive dialogue, and I think we did achieve what we set out to that I talked about this morning. I thank everyone for coming, and I hope we see you at the next one. Thank you.